Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, this is Andrew Heaton, friend of Christoph, friend of the Eastern Border Podcast, and friend to all dogs, telling you to support this program by going to patreon.com/theeasternborder. And let me tell you why. Because they keep trying to fucking kill him. That's why. He's doing this podcast for you. And they fucking blew his car up and tried to poison him. Dear God, go to patreon.com/theeasternborder. He's not going to tell you that, partly because he's eating Wendy's right now in my living room, but also, mostly, he's too humble. Not me. I'm telling you right now, this is a professional journalist. This is a war correspondent who is doing quality work that is literally dangerous, and he is not funded through some corporate stooge nor any type of large government agency. He's funded through you. You have an obligation to go to patreon.com/theeasternborder and make this show possible. Go to patreon.com/theeasternborder. Thank you.
Greetings, comrades, and welcome to the western border, I guess.
Western border.
I guess it's western border. We're in Texas right now with honorary Latvian and good friend of the show, Mr. Heaton. Lord Heaton, sorry.
Lord Uncle Heaton, a pleasure to be here. So happy to see you, Christoph, in the flesh. We met 2 years ago. We were connected through fans of this show when I was up in Riga and have maintained our remote friendship and... Whenever somebody tries to murder you, I reach out and I go, why don't you just come to Texas? Where, like, I'm not saying someone won't shoot you. I can't make that promise. But if somebody shoots you, they're at least going to look you in the eye and probably give you a gun first. Like, it'll be a dueling situation. So I've figured that this would be nice. And you took me up on it. You're here in Texas. We're so happy to have you here.
Well, I am here in Texas. But about the gun thing, you know, I was entering this country, you know, through Dallas. And where's my state-mandated gun? I thought though you're given one upon entry, and we didn't receive ours.
Yeah, I apologize. That's, you know, the bureaucracy's really been letting everybody down here recently. But we'll get you a gun before you leave. We'll get you a gun. Your lovely wife has a cowboy hat, which means that she's now eligible to vote here. You know, we'll get you a horse and stuff. My dog has adopted you.
Oh, yeah, the dog is amazing. I love Wallace.
Wallace is clearly stolen the hearts of our visiting Latvian friends.
Yeah, we're seriously going to get him honorary pet citizenship. It's going to be great. But, yeah, it's finally nice to be in a place where they don't actively try to kill me. That's a new thing for me. I'm always like worried about, you know, the next jet that I seek and might as well drop bombs. Probably won't. Hopefully it won't.
Honestly, Christoph, while you're here, I'd say diabetes is the biggest concern you've got. Diabetes and high cholesterol.
I tried all sorts of things here, but...
I wish we'd filmed you eating Wendy's, because that was the happiest I've ever seen a human being whilst eating Wendy's. Usually not nearly that happy, but you were absolutely delighted eating Wendy's.
Well, see, we only have a couple of fast food chains from the States in Lafayette. We have McDonald's, obviously, but it's like the burgers there are just tiny and it's not the same thing. And then we have KFC. KFC, which does not have either gravy, nor mashed potatoes, nor honey sauce.
Well, I'll say that's been one of the fun things about your trip for me is so much of what I consider very mundane has been fascinating for you and your wife. Like, we spent a decent chunk of the day just tracking down hummingbirds, which is not a fauna that is common to Latvia. And then just little pieces like, you were very excited to go to Wendy's. I apologize that we've not taken you to pharmacy yet, but that was very high on the list of things that you wanted to see. And it's been a lot of fun.
A pharmacy that also sells something else besides medicine is a totally new thing for me. But, well, sadly, as dear listeners, you will punch me if I don't do this. We have to turn to the silly news thing. I emailed you before we left, but I wanted to talk about the whole terror attack situation. And the fact how Russia is making new laws which are very much anti-immigrant in the situation where they need more workers. And I kind of wanted to compare this with your country. You've been struck by terror attacks here a couple of times. And
I actually heard a bomb from, like the Oklahoma City bombing I heard when I was a
really?
Kid. So, glad we're going to use the comparison because I'll note I am not following foreign policy nearly as much as you are. But I can talk about America. Americans are real good about talking about America. So, yeah.
Well, I kind of wanted to explain this whole situation because a lot of people still go, they're confused. Why would ISIS do this? ISIS-K. And, I'd like to explain here because, for one, Russia is allied to Iran. And Iran and ISIS are basically at war constantly. Secondly, Russia is a softer target these days than the United States. A lot softer. They're still a huge country and that people know and recognize on the world stage. But I find it weird when it's a softer target, and at the same time, if you go to the Moscow metro, you don't have to pull out your wallet at any time because they have such face recognition software everywhere and cameras everywhere, like a surveillance state, that you can just pay with your face.
Kind of like Beijing?
Yeah, even more so. Moscow is the most surveilled city on the planet at
really?
This point.
That's some creepy shit right there, because like with China, you know, they're at the point now, at least in the major cities, where, as I understand it, they can use facial recognition as your debit card.
Yeah, they do it in Russia, too. You can pay for the metro there.
Creepy thing about that is if you run afoul of the state, as in China, I don't know as much about Russia, but as in China, you get docked for having antisocial positions or whatever, and they go, well, now your credit card or your facial recognition only works within 3 miles of your house. So you're not allowed to buy groceries anywhere except within these 3 miles of your house. Like, they can really, really limit you to what you're doing.
The thing here is the fact that it's always funny how they took an hour and a half for the FSB, the security services, to get in the whole building. Like, many more people in the terror attack in Moscow died from, like, suffocating from the fire that was caused by the terrorists instead of actual terrorists, because after the terrorists had left, the FSB did not allow the services, the security services and the responders to go into the building.
Can I ask a very dumb question? I did not know that Russia was at loggerheads with ISIS. Russia is very much involved in a conflict with Ukraine.
Well, do you remember their involvement in Syria?
Yes.
Well, Russia used chemical weapons on civilians there.
Oh, okay. Well,
they also massively oppressed Muslims in their own country. Like, Moscow is a city of 14 million people. It's huge. And they have only four mosques there, although 20% of the population is Muslim.
20% of Moscow is Muslim?
Yes,
really?
Because, again, the Russian ethnic population is falling down. People from the Caucasus and Central Asia, who are all Muslim, they come to Moscow for work. Well, Russian nationalists keep on going with the fact that, oh, Russia for Russians only, but still they won't give up the territories they annexed violently, which contain Muslims. And they're surprised that, oh no, our glorious empire somehow contains Muslims, which we conquered, which didn't want to be there. And now they're coming to Moscow. Filthy, filthy, evil people apparently wanting to go within their own country, you know, to the capital to find better work. Such horrible evils, right?
And are these what we would call the Tartars, or are these?
Yeah.
Okay. So these are old ethnic Russian communities that are old ethnic Tartar communities that are Muslim that are in the interior. So
yes,
is that the same thing as Chechnya, or are they distinct from that?
They are distinct because Tartars are like on the east behind the Ural Mountains, and Chechnya are like those in the Caucasus Mountains next to Turkey. One's more Mongolian, another's more Turkic, but basically they're all Muslim populations there. And they're being hated by the Russian ultra-nationalists. So,
but that's one of the disturbing things. I don't remember if we talked about this, Christoph. My background's Eastern Orthodox. I am now a very friendly, low-wattage agnostic. I want everybody to get along. But my background's Eastern Orthodox, so like Russian Orthodox. Still have a soft spot for it. If I see a priest, I'll run up and get a blessing from him, because free blessing. Why would I turn down a free blessing? And from what I can tell, the Russian Orthodox Church has gone from being severely oppressed during the Soviet Union to having a resurgence in the 90s and 2000s to becoming a vehicle of nationalism in the modern Russian Federation.
Oh,
the,
yes.
The numbers that I'm seeing are people very much identify as Russian Orthodox, but without actually going to church. So it's more of like, I'm Russian Orthodox. So it's like, it's which bothers me. I don't want religion to become a handmaiden of nationalism.
Well, they do this, and remember that the current patriarch of the Russian Orthodox Church...
Kirill,
yeah. Or Pavel Gundyayev is more accurate, because he used to be a KGB colonel, you know.
Really?
Yeah. He used to be a KGB colonel.
Really?
Yeah. Massive KGB ties.
That's a bit of a skip to go from a KGB colonel in the Soviet Union to it. Did he like...
No, he was the KGB guy sent into the Orthodox Church to monitor them.
Oh, he was like an insider?
Yes.
Well, and they made him patriarch?
Yeah, because that...
Does he acknowledge this? Is this established?
Well, of course, we have documentation evidence of another thing.
Really? And so he's like, yes, I worked for the KGB?
No, he denies that part, but the problem is he can't delete all the document trail. We physically have evidence of him being an KGB informant and everything.
So he was a bishop, but he was an informant.
Yeah, okay. And he also was in pay with the KGB. He had achieved the rank of colonel. He was like on service.
Okay. So he wasn't just an informer. He was an actual KGB officer.
Yes, an actual KGB colonel.
Really? Yeah. Wow.
And then he decides on such great projects as making Russian Orthodox statues in bronze, like of most important patriarchs of Russia. He's going to just put them in front of St. Basil's Cathedral. Well, the first statue he built was of himself.
Really?
Yeah, and then he has one of the world's biggest super yachts as well, a couple of Rolex watches, you know, that sort of thing. He's get paid very well.
I'm okay with the patriarch having one Rolex watch, but the super yacht, that seems excessive, doesn't it? Because, like, listen, I don't want to step on any toes here, but I did read the New Testament back when I was religious, and Jesus mostly talks about giving your money away. He really talks about giving your money away a lot. I would say that that's one of the top things for Jesus, is just give your money to poor people.
Well, look, it's the modern Russian Orthodox Church and their leadership who has also admitted and called up for the total extermination of all Ukrainians, who have also said that war itself is a good thing because it purifies society from impure elements. Who has declared that AIDS does not exist, and if it did, it would be a capitalist invention. Who also has claimed that the EU invented oral sex, and therefore it is immoral and bad.
Thank you, Brussels. Really appreciate that, guys. We're going to send a little bit more money to NATO now that I know that. I really appreciate that.
I mean, and those are, like, that's not even a comedy skit. You don't need a comedy skit to speak with this. At the same time, recently, an underground sex shop network was discovered running through some like monasteries in Russia too.
Well, I'm deeply disturbed about the war element. That, like, another thing, Jesus talked about, you know, live by the sword, die by the sword. Peter, put down your sword. We're like, I don't want religion animating warfare. But like at the same time, the Ukrainian Orthodox Church is an autocephalous Orthodox Church. Like, the Ukrainians are the same religion.
Look, that was a huge mess, basically, politically and everything, and the Russians opposed it. And as far as we've seen videos, they used their contacts in the FSB to try to even poison the Patriarch of Constantinople, which is kind of like the Pope of Orthodoxy.
When was this? Was this during the Soviet Union, or was this...
No, that was like recently. That was in 2022. Like, when they
tried to poison the Patriarch of Constantinople?
Well, it seems so, because the Russian monks offered him some tea.
Uh-huh.
The local monastery guys, where the Patriarch was there, they just took the tea away from him and didn't allow to drink him at all.
Okay.
We don't have much more evidence, but the video is kind of appalling, where the Patriarch of Constantinople tries to drink this tea given to by Russians, and he's like stopped at the last minute and said, no, don't touch this, we're moving this over to the lab. You drink this one. Like, they really pushed him away, because as far as I know from the video and documentation, there was at least an attempt of him being poisoned, although the Orthodox Church will never admit this.
Well, I have to throw in, just not knowing anything about the situation, that could be any number of things. If all we know is a guy was offered tea and then his handler said, don't drink it, it could have been a photo op. It could have been a lot of different things.
Yeah, I know, but basically the very fact that, no, I use this as evidence, is he wasn't trying to be poisoned at that occasion. But they wouldn't be so worried about usual tea if there wouldn't be some basis for it, because Orthodox Church doesn't really do those things. They try to be, you know, you know a lot about the Pope, right? The Pope's open. The Patriarch in Constantinople, he's very self, like, he's very close to the religious ties. He doesn't make public statements often. He's not the kind of guy to do a massive photo op. So there must be a real...
He also has to kind of keep his head down, because he's living in Turkey.
They're definitely, as far as my sources go, they're convinced that this is just a precaution, because there have been some previous attempts.
Why would the Russians want to kill him?
because of the autocephaly thing. That's a major blow to Moscow.
But, and he's in favor of Ukraine? Because Ukraine's been autocephalous for a while.
No. He gave the autocephaly to Ukraine, how Orthodox Church works. He was the one to sign the thing that they're autocephalous. The problem is that all the income from the church donations, you have to send some part to Moscow if they're not autocephalous. When they became like autocephalous, then they got to keep those donations. So Moscow lost about $30 million of income per year.
Well, it sounds like they could just sell that super yacht and they'd be fine.
Well, you are obviously not informed about what Monsieur Kirill wants to do. Because why would he sell his super yacht? That's a very non-Christian thing to do, you know. Obviously, Christians all love super yachts. We like to just amass them and organize sex shops in our monasteries, because that's totally what Jesus said in the Bible, of course,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Well, I'll have
Seems
a word with
so
him.
At least.
I'll have a word with him next time I see him. Yeah.
No, but this is an interesting part, like about Oklahoma bombing and terrorism in general. What I don't get, really, in this situation is how does it affect the public? Because I've heard a lot of... I've made these very similar situations, but the whole war in general, since a lot of people smarter than I have compared the ongoing war in Ukraine to 9/11 just extending for 2 years. And I feel the emotional damage it has also caused me. And for one, I'm finally having some relaxed time here in Texas. I love Texas. I'm going to talk with a Texan accent for a while now, I suppose.
But, you nailed it. You nailed it.
I hope so.
It's like I'm talking to George Strait right now.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I'm not blushing, comrades. But as we're lucky enough in Latvia to not have such a thing. How do these acts work? Like, what's the point? For me, as I haven't been in the country with such a thing, it's an emotional damage and it's heavy, but I don't know. It doesn't seem very effective, to be honest.
Yeah, so I can talk about this, about how a country reacts to a terror strike firsthand pretty well. So let's make three distinctions of the type of terror strikes that might be happening. One, I don't know that we even call it a terror strike, but we'd call it like a governmental crackdown on a potentially terroristic organization. Those have a tendency to really reduce faith in government. So this is before my time, but it directly precipitated the Oklahoma City bombing that I was witness to, was Ruby Ridge, where some weird white nationalist...
He wasn't even a white nationalist. I watched a documentary about him recently.
He was a kind of wacky militia guy, but he, just so far as I know, was hanging out by himself in the mountains.
Yeah, he basically, his neighbors were the wacky guys, and he just wanted to communicate with his neighbors. As far as I know of, he was a weird person.
Yeah, he was a weirdo, but
he wasn't really messing around with anyone.
Really. The FBI or possibly the Department of Justice, I don't remember, basically decided they were going to like flush him out, and they ended up shooting his wife, and his like daughter had to crawl across his wife's body. It was a horrible thing, and that had a kind of red alert thing for a lot of Americans of like, you know, he sounds like a dick, but was he doing anything that was worth being shot over? And like that kind of thing, when the government's coming in and going, I think you're weird, we're going to force you to not do this, I think really atrophies faith in government. You're also very close right now to Waco. You passed through Waco on your way down here from Dallas.
Oh yeah, we wanted to go to the Waco Museum, but
yeah,
we had to get to you in time. So.
Right. Well, I appreciate that you find me more interesting than Waco. Again, like if there were instances of child molestation or anything going on like that, that's a very legitimate vestige for government exploration. But if it was just a weird cult and they weren't bothering anybody, then they should have been left alone. I don't know all the details on that.
Let me comment on this one.
Sure.
After the terror attack in Moscow, if previously there were far-right militias in Russia, mostly national Bolsheviks, mm-hmm. It's like national socialists, obviously Nazis, except they're national Bolsheviks. Their
right.
flag is literally a Nazi flag, except for place swastika with a hand grenade.
Okay, yeah.
These guys are now cooperating with police to seek out the various Central Asian people from Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, all those places. They just, you know... that basically forced them to leave and beat them up and be violent against them. At the same time, the Russian government needs those people as well. But like when I saw the first time when a nationalist militia together with local cops just go to the local migrant pub where they sit in and just arrested everyone. Half of them recently mobilized to be sent to Ukraine. Other half was just beaten up. Fun times.
Fun times. Well, I the only reason I mention all this is I think that there is a... When the active element of government versus terror comes from the government and it overplays its hand, I think that it has a capacity to stir up that kind of militia element. Now, the actual terror attack, like a proper terror attack, in 1994, 2004, I think it was, we had the Oklahoma City bombing, which up until 9/11 was the largest terror attack in the United States. I was in fourth grade. I heard the bomb from the playground. Like my friends and I were walking across the playground. We heard a very loud thunderclap noise, which later that day we found out was the sound of 118 people, I think, dying. I can't remember the exact number, but it was a couple of nut jobs, Timothy McVeigh and I forget the other one's name, had weaponized a car full of fertilizer to make a nitrogen bomb and had just blown the face off this building and killed a bunch of people, including children. It was a horrible situation. It was a horrible thing. Weirdly, the effects of that from domestic terrorism, where it was two white guys like me that thought the federal government had gone too far. And by the way, I think the federal government's gone too far, but I wouldn't fucking blow up a building. I'm saying we had some overlap in the sense that they were government skeptics and that they were white guys from America, as opposed to what we saw on 9/11. That's what I mean to say. I'm not in any way trying to give credit to Timothy McVeigh as a piece of shit. But the effect from that, that I saw as a child of domestic terrorism happening and the response from it was weirdly very positive in the sense that the community really, really rallied, really, really came together. I was in fourth grade. My dad drove by and we would drive by the site where they were actively trying to haul out people from the rubble. And he'd go like, I hear you guys need suntan lotion or sunscreen. And they'd go, yeah. And he'd go, okay. And he'd like open his glove compartment, and just hand him sunscreen. And like other people would literally pull the boots off their feet. Like it was a very common thing at this time for people to just drive by where the site was and give, you know, bottles of water, meals, literally the shoes they were wearing, if they were protective boots for workers and things. So the experience that had for me was
Hi, everyone. Annette here. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Eastern Border. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank all of you who are supporting us on Patreon or via our website. Your financial support is really what keeps this show going.
So, in my case, I think a significant part of why I'm so weirdly optimistic is because I went through that situation and I saw how there are always going to be a couple of bad apples, but I think the majority of people, everybody you see around you, the majority of people, if you fall down, will pick you up. And so that was what I got out of it. And when we go to 9/11 and we get an outsider coming in and killing far more people with the Twin Towers, I think it's a very, very different situation.
And I'm just mentioning here, I've been to New York, I've seen the memorial there, and it's really powerful, to be honest. It's one of the best built memorials I've seen because of the whole void feeling it creates. Because I remember I was in school when that happened, and yeah, it shook us as well, because that was such an unprecedented, unthinkable thing, as we really haven't had any acts of terrorism in my country, that even I think it was in third grade when that happened, 9/11. And yeah, I still remember that day, because like even in Lafayette, all the schools just stopped teaching anything, and we were just all hanging around the TVs watching things as they happen, and we're just very much in shock, because, you know, like I've told you, we genuinely like the United States, you know, it's our third favorite country. It's our third favorite country after Estonia and Lithuania. Which
hey,
are
we'll
old
take
neighbors,
it. Top so. Five, great. Yeah, I think that one was very, very different. With the Oklahoma City bombing, it was also a lot smaller, but it was, I don't know, it was two assholes and everybody coming together. The whole country rallied behind us. You know, people were flying in to help, things like that. 9/11 was very, very different. 9/11 ended the post-Soviet euphoria that America had. So I'm part of a very, very narrow generation of Americans who was alive and cognizant when the Berlin Wall fell down and was alive and cognizant when the Soviet Union imploded.
I want to comment on this one because I agree with you. As you say, 9/11 ended an epoch here. The same thing happened with the beginning of the war. Because currently in Europe, all of the historians are dealing with end of the Cold War, 1991, Soviet Union collapses. And they, at least in our end, they also separate the period of the beginning is clear, collapse of the Soviet Union, and everyone basically agrees that that period ended on the 22nd of February 2022. Like, that's definitely going to be an era in history in my end. And I can see how here it would be in that sense, definitely the start of the war and 9/11 are comparable events in the whole impact thing.
And it did change all that, because we had this wonderful period where the Soviet Union fell. Kinnemer has exploded. The Klingon Empire is going kaput, and the idea was hey, liberal democracy won. Like, liberal democracy and capitalism won. Everybody agrees democracy and capitalism are great. Look, Russia's our friend now. We're like, Mikhail Gorbachev's doing Pizza Hut commercials. Yeltsin's getting fucking shit canned with Bill Clinton. Like we're all buddies. Yay, we won. History's over. Woohoo. So we, like, I had like the touch of that. I was in middle school while that was happening, where we're like, that's it. Everybody loves America and we won. And we're all friends now. And then 9/11 happens and we go, oh shit. No, a lot of people want us to die. Turns out a lot of people want us to die. And it turns out that like that feeling of we did it, mission accomplished optimism, that is now concluding. And America became way more paranoid. It did have a rallying effect. I think whenever you have a threat to the collective, to the group, there is a rallying effect. There is a morale boost because you suddenly feel a spirit de corps with your neighbors. But also a lot of paranoia came out of that. And a hell of a lot of really bad policy came out of that.
It also makes me think is my grandma had relatives back up in Milwaukee. I don't know what state that is. It's Minnesota, probably.
Minnesota.
Yeah, right. Like she went there in 1998.
Wait, hold on, maybe Wisconsin. Either way, one of those two states. Yeah.
Like, I know it's Milwaukee.
Yeah. That's where Wisconsin, I think, yeah.
That's where my grandma's cousin lived because she immigrated in World War II. And I remember my grandma going over to the United States in 1998 and flying through New York. And I've been to a JFK. Like here in Dallas, I spent about 10 minutes in customs and everything, but I know English as well. I'm fluent in English and everything. But my grandma wasn't, and she was like sent cards to show to people at airports to let them through, like customs and everything, and it worked. And she spent a month over there in Milwaukee. And now today, I don't even know how you get in the United States without knowing English. I have no idea as a foreigner, because I had to complete my ESTA, like the ESTA thing, and then, well, at least here in Dallas, it was super simple. Well, not here, Dallas, as in. It's not here. We're in Austin, and I now know the local rivalries thing. I cannot say here by using the word Dallas, because Austin and Dallas are not.
I get what you're saying, but also Dallas is an inferior city to Austin, Texas.
Of course, this it isn't. It just he also thinks Arby's is a cool place to eat. You know, just
Arby's is a fine institution. Arby's is great. I was surprised you got so excited about Wendy's when Arby's was available to you. There should be songs about Arby's is fantastic.
My point is that I don't even know like how that changed tourism and international travel, because like my grandmother, who didn't speak English, I don't know how she
made it. Made it much worse. Like, and it's getting a little bit better just because we've come up with like various ways to expedite it, like TSA pre and clear and global entry and things like that. But from a travel perspective, it made it far worse forever. Just, I mean, you can argue that it's safer. However, I would point out that it's very difficult to do that when, at least last I checked, the TSA that handles airport security will not, perhaps they have, but the last time I looked at this is maybe 5-10 years ago, they won't release the actual data on what they've stopped. They'll just go, trust me, we're working very hard, but we can't tell you for security reasons. And I, as a taxpayer, I'm like, well, that sounds like bullshit. Like, you need to be able to say what you're doing for us to justify this. Otherwise, it's potentially security theater.
Well, I can give you my ESTA questions because I saved some of them.
Have you ever been a member of a terrorist organization? That stuff? Yeah.
That is definitely one. They don't ask about the Nazi part anymore. You can be a Nazi all you want. Doesn't matter.
I suspect that's because we think we beat them pretty soundly.
Hopefully
so.
But they asked me, have I had Ebola?
A what?
Ebola.
Oh, Ebola. I think you said bullwhip. And no. I was like, that, I mean.
The bullwhip is cool too, but yeah. Ebola is like a bit slightly harsher. Have you ever committed or are you intending to commit acts of terrorism within the United States of America?
Man, we really have a lot of.
I mean, if you insist.
A lot of emphasis writing in this honor system here. Don't tell anybody this, Christoph. But I think some of these terrorists wouldn't answer that question honestly if it was posed to them, raising questions about how efficacious it is to have it all.
They also asked me, will I be selling drugs to Americans?
Nice. This is some
pointy. I'm like, thanks for giving me ideas, but.
Yeah, this is some pointy-headed bureaucratic nonsense right here.
No, I think the reason is that if you do, they at least have a thing to pin you down on in courts. You know, they can't.
Oh, because you've committed forgery.
You have like.
Oh, interesting. I thought about that. So it's like a way of adding an additional charge. Not only did you do this thing, you also in writing said you wouldn't do it. That's interesting. Travel became worse. Like, I don't really remember this because I was in high school when 9/11 happened. But prior to 9/11, you wouldn't have to. You'd have to go through a metal detector, but it wasn't nearly so complicated. You just kind of walked through. But basically, that was it. You just walked up to the gate and showed them your ticket. Like, you could. It was much more porous. There's a couple of airports here in America. I don't remember which one it is. I can't remember. There's one airport. They designed it where all of the food court is outside of the gates, which made sense before 9/11 because you could go back and forth. You just went, I'm going to Terminal 4, and they'd go, have a good day. And like now, though, the place is a shit show because you have to go in and out of security constantly if you want to go get something to eat. But the bigger things, though, I want to say, though, the much worse things that weren't just that's irritating, but doesn't really affect life beyond irritation. The much worse things were Americans became far more comfortable with government surveillance. We became far more comfortable with widespread, insidious evasion of warrants, something that our people have hitherto taken very seriously. And we went to war with Iraq, which was an absolutely disastrous foreign policy decision that left hundreds of thousands of people dead for no good reason, or net negative reasons, and also cost us a couple trillion dollars. So terrorism's bad.
Well, this is what I want to ask you, because this is where we actually might disagree for once. Like I told you in the car, you're my favorite person to disagree with.
Thank you.
Because for one, we thankfully show people that, yes, you can disagree with someone and not yell at them.
Yeah.
Also, I have purchased a Ross Perot campaign pen here in because I had to. And no one in Lafayette knows who Ross Perot is.
Really? Yeah.
But how to explain it to Evita. But I have one, and I thought it was kind of funny. That I have one. That like today's bill, I think it was today, basically, where the United States is finally voting on the aid package to Ukraine, which they have been screaming for a long while. They're also giving money to Israel and beefing up your own defense budget. I know you don't like United States defense spending, but in this situation, and I'll get to the tricky questions now because I have to investigate you. I asked you yesterday about the fact that, you know, what if, say, Poland would get a nuclear missile versus United States keeping Poland nuke free, you'd say you'd rather give money to Poland.
Yes. Yeah, so
I, however, would rather, I disagree with you on this one, because I, for one, would be much comfortable with us getting our nuke ourselves, because, for one, what if you get a government in the United States that doesn't want to give money to Europe and that breaks its promises, because we've seen a lot of promises broken. In this case, if you'd be in my position, I hope you understand my view, why I think Poland getting a nuke is a bit better. But what makes you so strongly opposed? What makes you chosen this situation? Sorry.
Sure. So if we're talking about nukes specifically, my main thing is I do not want to live on a planet where at any given moment, one person who has an erratic judgment call can plunge the planet into thermonuclear war and reduce the population by 90%. And it seems to me that the more people that have that red button power, the more likely it is that that will eventually happen. I would love to go completely the opposite direction. I would love to have a massive arms reduction treaty with Russia where we both agree to reduce our nuclear stockpile by 90%, which would still be more than enough to cripple both countries with just 10% of the nuclear weapons we have right now. Like the British Trident Force, I think they've got, it's either three or six, sub. I think it's 3 to 6 submarines, I can't remember.
The British have about 280 nuclear warheads.
Right.
The French have about 300.
Yeah.
Russia has about 6,000. So does the United States,
yes, exactly. Thank you very much. I don't have those numbers off the top of my head, but I'm glad you do. So 280 nuclear warheads, which seems very tiny compared to 6,000 nuclear warheads.
But it's still enough to cause insane damage.
280 nuclear warheads that Britain has, their little boutique nuclear arsenal, is more firepower than every bomb dropped in World War II. It is enough to level Europe. Britain right now, with its 3 to 6 submarines, I don't remember how many they have, and 280 nuclear, could absolutely level Europe and make the rubble bounce. 6,000 is an insane amount. 6,000 is enough to just knock the whole planet over 3 feet from the size of the force.
I have a quote, both of our, I'm sure you listened to him too, our good old buddy Dan Carlin here, and like bomb us back to the Stone Age, I suppose.
All of that stuff. So noting that I'm and we've narrowly avoided nuclear war. We've narrowly avoided it multiple times. There's a wonderful book called I want to say it's 7 Arguments Against Nuclear Weapons by Ward Wilson. Ward Wilson's the key guy, but he has a chapter in it where he talks about 6 instances that we very nearly went to nuclear war that we know of. These are things that have been revealed to us by the government.
Hi everyone, Annette here. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Eastern Border. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank all of you who are supporting us on Patreon or via our website. Your financial support is really what keeps this show going, so thank you from the bottom of our heart. If you're not a Patreon and would like to become one, head over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/theeasternborder, or support us via our website, www.theeasternborder.lv. That said, hope you're enjoying this episode, and talk to you later. Bye!
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Little plug here, by the way, if you're listening to this, I have to say thank you, Mr. Heaton, for writing my Patreon plugs. This is the midpoint of the episode, therefore I'm mentioning this. Thank you. You probably heard the sound at the beginning. Heaton just told me to shut up and sit in the other room. I was cringing and walking out to have a wave, but I wouldn't have ever done this. So if you're already not listening to Political Orphanage, please go and subscribe now, because Heaton here, he manages to be a better marketer for my show than I have ever would be. But yeah, midpoint over, carrying on.
To get to your overall question, though, generally speaking, I think that the United States is overextended in terms of our foreign deployments. I think we have our fingers in too many pies, and I think that we have...
That is the first time I've heard that statement. I will note this one down.
Yeah, we have, I think, also a very good track record of picking and arming bad dictators that end up biting us in the ass. So I would love for American foreign policy to be one that is based around being a good neighbor more than being a cop, noting all of that, noting that my tendencies are much more... towards reluctance in deployment abroad. I would be willing to pay more money to NATO or maintain it in order to keep nuclear proliferation from happening. Not that I don't trust the Poles, they seem like good people, but every new button that could fire a nuclear weapon is one more point where there could be a friction that escalates into something else. A nuclear war would be the worst possible foreign policy thing imaginable. So, no, I don't want it. I will say it's interesting from a labor perspective, and that it would allow us to get the hell out of everywhere. Kissinger at one point, I don't know if he reversed position on this, but Kissinger had wanted to just give nukes to Taiwan and been like, well, we'll just give them 20, 30 nukes. That'll keep China from wanting to invade them, which just have like a little regional mutually assured destruction, and probably would have. And we wouldn't have to think about Taiwan the last 50 years. But at the same time, the likelihood that we get some kind of World War I escalation where Poland goes to war with, I don't know, Georgia, I'm trying to think of a country, Kazakhstan or something. And like, and the nukes end up hitting them, and we have to, now, well, they're a NATO member, so now we have to go to war on Poland's case. And then somehow this escalates. I think nuclear proliferation is a really, really bad idea. We should all be working to get rid of nukes as much as we can. My goal would be to get like 100 nukes each for America and Russia.
Yeah, but that's the thing which I want to also ask you, because I've been watching, as you've heard, by the way, because I'm sitting here in Heaton's place, and Yeah, he's actually seen me watching my Russian news sources. He's heard them. And the big issue is that currently most of Russian opposition are calling you all cowards. Because not even going nuclear, like, and yeah, I agree with this fact that Putin only understands some pushback. However, the question here is that why would people, like, giving out nukes and everything? Russia, so far, at least a lot of people think that Russia is ready to go nuclear if need be. Like, if Russia would go nuclear, would you also go nuclear as well? Like, what's the starting point here? And to what point we arm countries? You're saying that we should avoid nuclear war, but do we accept genocide of a people instead of a nuclear war? Because that's what's happening in Ukraine. And I don't
think... May I pause you for a moment? So should we threaten China with nuclear war against the Uyghurs or the Tibetans? Tibet is being erased by
the
Chinese.
I'm not saying it's an easy question. That's the response.
I mean, I would say no, and it's a similar situation. Now, granted, it's a fate accomplice.
Let me just explain this. As you might have heard, a bunch of my fellow Eastern Europeans are asking me questions about America. So I'm giving you these questions just so that, you know, they're also listening to the show. And the fact that they're not asking why is just, because I get this question a lot. Why is the United States not threatening Russia with a nuclear war? Why are they're not just stopping the whole thing and declaring war on Russia? That is a thing I hear often. And they honestly don't understand what's going on, because, as we've spoken before, well, Russia itself has had a lot of issues with democracy and evil. Even the people on the more democratic side, they don't understand exactly the processes in the United States and how this whole system actually works. So that's the intent of my question. So could you please explain that one? For at this point, my Russian opposition listeners, this one's for you.
I'm happy to listen to that, or happy to respond to that. I want to make sure I understand the bearings of the question, though. Is the idea America being the standard bearer for the Western world and democracy, why are we not coming to the aid of a democratic regime that's threatened by Russia?
Exactly, yes, because a lot of people in Russian opposition, at least. I understand most of your answer here. I approximately can understand what you're going to say, but like, I'd rather have a real American explain the situation than, you know, me retelling the answer at some point.
Well, the first thing that I would tell your listeners is that there is not in any way a consensus on this in American foreign policy. I would remind your European listeners that when we're talking about America, I would rather you think of America as a North American version of the EU than an individual country. We are more similar to the EU than we are to Sweden or to Latvia or to Lithuania or anything like that. It's a very large country with very diverse opinions. It's massively ethnically diverse. So in the same way that it would be difficult to go, what do Europeans think about foreign policy? Because there's probably more than one opinion. Ditto America. I would say, broadly speaking, the two foreign policy camps in America, this goes back a very, very long time. Should we be proactive in engaging the world and fighting the good fight and arming the good fight and trying to put our finger on the scales when we want to pick leaders that we think would be better? Or do we think that America should mind its own business, be a good neighbor, and support in non-military ways? The people that are on the proactive side, on the political orphanage, about a year ago, I interviewed Bill Kristol, William Kristol, who was an advisor for George W. Bush during the war in Iraq. He would say that the reason that we haven't had a World War III or other comparable conflicts is precisely because America has been so involved in the world stage over the last 50 years, and that when America pulls back, you get ISIS. When America pulls back, you get Russia invading Ukraine. And his solution would be America needs to be very, very active and robust in forging alliances, maintaining alliances, funding military comrades in other countries, et cetera, et cetera. I think a lot of people do that. I will say the American administration thinks that. So Biden and Blinken are both in that camp. The president and the secretary of state are both in that camp. And probably most of Congress is in that camp. That is definitely the establishment position of most of the people in Washington, D.C. The other position, and I'm more partial to this myself, is when we add up all the corpses from America's fuck-ups over the last 50 years of Vietnam, which I think was a useless, bloody conflict, and Iraq, which was a useless, bloody conflict, and all of the other countries that we've gone into for no gain of their people or ours, it ends up being about 6 million people we've killed, about one Holocaust. And that makes me very reticent as an American. I, as an American, want to acknowledge that we have fucked up several times. And we've often done it for reasons that are perhaps self-serving more than merely being pro-democracy. And so I think that our default position should be one of peace and neutrality. Doesn't mean we always have to be, but the default should be peace and neutrality. And the default should be, how do we work this out without killing anybody? That's the default, right? That's where I'm coming. So when we get into the very, very complex issue of, say, Ukraine, I look at that and go, right now we've got a proxy war with Russia. That does not strike me as an ideal situation to be in. And we very much disagree on this. I think that we played an active role in exacerbating the Russian position to ignite this conflict.
I vehemently disagree to the amount, to the role that America played in this. You played some part, but I do not agree it's a major part. But then again, well, here you go. This is our point of disagreement, which is probably causing other issues. But carry on, please.
Well, so my thing there would be, I take a fairly realist position when it comes to foreign policy, when it comes to international relations theory. So realism is basically, look, it's all about power. It's just like, imagine countries are billiard balls knocking into each other. It's just power. There are other things, but power is overwhelmingly important in terms of what determines these. The relationship between countries in terms of that power is important. So fall of the Soviet Union happens. Great. We've won, as I said earlier. We didn't have a problem with the Russian people. We had a problem with the Soviets. We had a problem with the totalitarian communist regime. And we should have applauded the Russians for having a largely bloodless coup getting rid of one of the worst regimes in human history. That is something that we should have been actively supporting them on. And we should have been looking to make bridges
that
with
is,
them.
That is a thing that they also mention a lot, because a lot of Russians today who are ultra-nationalist and pro-war, they felt betrayed by the West in general in the 90s. Because, again, as I explained before in my own show, for example, privatization of Latvia, and similar in Russia, I'm just using my example, because in Russia it was like way worse, but the similar situation happened. The people who knew about how capitalism works were the organized crime guys who smuggled in stuff. So they were able to buy off of privatization vouchers for about 10% of face value from the locals. So it was a whole mess, tons of criminal stuff, and it was never explained, and a lot of people still think that, you know, they see capitalism as that. So
Russia devolved into a kleptocracy almost immediately. I mean, I don't think that it went in a nice Hayekian market economy like Switzerland or anything like that.
The average Russian person thinks that the West gave us capitalism, but they did not explain how it works at all.
I think that's accurate. I've never been to Russia, but I have been to Albania. And when I was in Albania, like talking to people, they're like, so democracy is where you elect your cousin to get the graft and then you get some of the graft, right? Like that was just very common. Is like, yeah, democracy. Like you distribute corruption more broadly because you can get your cousin elected. And I was like, that's not how we see it. So I think there's something to that. That being said, though, like when the Soviet Union's gone, I don't think we should have looked at Russia as a permanent enemy. And I don't think they are a permanent enemy, and I don't want them to be. I would like Germany's not a permanent enemy. Japan's not a permanent enemy.
I would love Russia to not be a permanent enemy, but, well, so far throughout our history, they have been. But that's my perspective again, which is why,
I think that's fairly accurate. And the really shitty part of that under realist international theory is that you have buffers and satellite zones and zones of influence, and you guys are unfortunately stuck between a couple of large powers that has not benefited you historically. I don't envy you that at all. Noting that there are these large powers, when the Soviet Union fell, George H.W. Bush said, you know, we're not looking to encircle Russia. We're not looking to tighten the noose around this country. We bid that by a couple of years and then subsequently started inviting in all of the previous zones around Russia to join NATO. Totally makes sense for all of those countries to join. I would want to as well. I think NATO expansion is viewed by Russia as an existential threat. I think one of the things that America doesn't get that I wish that we were more aware of in foreign policy is that most other countries don't view them as the bad guy. Like, we have an idea in American foreign policy, well, we're the good guy, and China and Russia, you're the bad guy, and you know you're the bad guy. I don't think they think they're the bad guy. I think they think everybody's the bad guy, or they're the good guy and we're the bad guy. But the idea that because we're building a defensive alliance that completely circles you, but we're a good guy, don't worry about it, is nonsensical. In the same way that if Russia formed a defensive alliance with Mexico and Canada, it would freak us the fuck out.
Well, the thing is, Russian has its own little tiny NATO. It's called, the OSCD, or one of those things. But they're the only military alliance whose only wars have been between its own members, and Russia has not gotten involved. Like, Azerbaijan and Armenia are both parts of this military alliance, you know.
To bring it on home, in terms of the chronology here, I'll make a final delineation. I want to make a very keen distinction here between moral culpability and prudence. I think that Putin and Russia are morally culpable for the fight that is happening in Ukraine. I think that the buck rests with Russia. It is a evil situation that they that Putin and his advisors are morally culpable for. In terms of prudence, I do think that by George W. Bush saying we're going to bring in Georgia and Ukraine into NATO back in 2005, it's not a coincidence that a month after he said that, what happens? Russia immediately invades Georgia. And shortly after he made that comment, there start being drills against Ukraine. I think that our relationship with Russia in this conflict has been, that's the drunk at the end of the bar who wants to pick a fight with somebody. And we're going, hey, fuck you. You couldn't pick me in a fight. Again, that guy's still responsible for it. But I think that we have goaded them in a way that was imprudent for us. And if we had attempted to assuage their fears that Ukraine was going to be a Western launch point into Russia, we might have been able to avoid this.
Well, see, there is the fundamental mistake of they. If you talk about Russian people and Yeltsin and the Russia of the early 90s, then I'd agree with you. I'd be fine. Like, because at that point, I could call it they. Right now, what you're meaning is that Russian people don't want to war with NATO. They don't feel that worried. At least they wouldn't be unless, you know, they hadn't been fed 20 years of Putin's propaganda who took over the media. I really just, I think the crux of our thing lies with the fact that I don't believe Putin represents Russian people.
No, neither do I. Neither do I. He's an unelected regime, quasi-dictator character, yes.
Well, by now, even more than quasi.
But I do think he's rational. I don't think he's moral, but I think he's rational.
He Ramzan Kadyrov isn't, which is why many people will bring him down. But I thought, you know, I think Putin mostly was rational. Currently, I don't consider him a very rational actor simply because, well, he's surrounded himself with sycophants constantly. He has eliminated every naysayer there. And like when he had a meeting with his war correspondents, who, by the way, pick up guns and shoot people, which is a thing that disrupts the health of all of us war correspondents, because that means you can't trust the press sign.
I would sure prefer war correspondents be kept sacrosanct.
If a war correspondent picks up guns and aids one certain side, like, you know, that makes it a bad situation. So I'm trying to be safe there. Not very succeeding. The big idea is that Putin just sort of sees this as his own personal backyard, and he's betrayed all this stuff, and he does not represent Russian people, at least I think so. So I would agree with you about this whole situation about going it in if it would be like Russian people who just voted against this. If it would be like, if Putin had been honestly elected or something, and he'd represented the will of Russian people, I'd say, yeah, you're right on this one. But for now, I think that the fact that Ukraine would join NATO hurts more Putin and his cronies' feelings than he does Russia. Because for one, Putin hates the most is the fact that he constantly spreads in the propaganda news the fact that, okay, you guys don't have good salaries. You're making way less money. But at least, look, you're not as degenerate as the Westerners and stuff like that, you see? And he can play this on because many people in Russia haven't traveled. However, if Ukraine would join like EU and NATO and start prospering, as about 30% of Russia's population would be like, have relatives in Ukraine, then he wouldn't be able to hide it.
Right.
He
would know that the idea that there's like an alternate universe Russia
you could see how Putin's regime is actually hurting you and how he's doing bad things. I think the main threat, really, because NATO's expansion isn't a threat for Russia militarily.
I don't buy that explanation for two very quick examples.
Okay, sure. But
South Korea existing has not thrown North Korea into chaos. The North Koreans are and there's very clearly a Korea that works better, that is an even better one-to-one ratio than Ukraine and Russia. Taiwan's more free and prosperous than mainland China.
I'm telling you the opinion that has so far that I've heard from most Russia experts. So I've heard this opinion, and it's not just my one. It's
I've heard this from multiple people. This idea that kind of Ukraine is a city on a hill that the Russians could look to and go, well, how come we can't have an elective democracy?
They're not there yet, but they could become one, which then hurt Russia.
Putin wants to snuff it out because he's afraid. Yeah, I get it. I don't think that that's the most likely explanation. When you look at the timeline of Russia invading Ukraine, like what has Russia always wanted for the last 600 years? It's wanted a warm water port. It has one. It has one in, I guess, in Crimea. It had a naval base there. Ukraine is Crimean.
Yeah, and Sevastopol, yes.
Yeah, Sevastopol, and it has a military base there. And then Ukraine starts pivoting towards the West and saying, well, maybe we'll join NATO. And then what happens? Russia seizes that port. Like it just declares Crimea as that. And it's reacting to the threat of Ukraine joining NATO and being encircled. So
let me ask you a question. Like, okay, sure, you're talking about geopolitical interests, but shouldn't, like, West care about the fact that Russia is under a brutal dictatorship? Even if Putin wouldn't be doing this stuff, even if he wouldn't invade anyone, would it still be okay to just treat a country with a brutal dictator on top of it as normal?
Let me ask you a question. Should we invade North Korea?
Good comeback, really, there.
I think that there are truly horrible situations going on right now. I don't think the Holocaust ever ended. I think the Holocaust is happening around the world. North Korea has had a three-generational Holocaust going on.
You have not been in a society that's living under that regime. I'm pretty sure a bunch of North Koreans right now would answer you, of course it would be okay for U.S. to invade North Korea. Because I know that that's my instinctive response, and I'm just explaining this because I'm trying to be somewhat unbiased, but see, from all the horror stories that I've heard from my family and people, yes, I know where you're coming from, but I've just grown up in a totally different society, so I know there's a lot of people out there, including even possibly me, but I'd have to think about this very hard, that would definitely say, yeah, it probably would really be better if U.S. would invade. I just wanted to explain deeper than, you know, it's not that I'm a warmonger, just that I can see where this is coming from.
I'm very much a proponent of human liberty and an antagonist of authoritarianism. So I very much sympathize with that position, and perhaps so. Maybe a better example would be Tibet and the Uyghurs. Tibet is a conquered province of China that is being eliminated culturally and historically from their homeland, much the way Ukraine worries about being eliminated by Russia.
Yeah, and the things that the Chinese are doing, well, they lifted this from the Soviet textbook. This is what they're doing is exactly the same thing as the Soviets were doing.
And as much of a travesty as that is, going to nuclear war with China would be a lot worse.
That is true.
And so that's kind of my thing is... When Japan and Russia went to war in 1905, thank you. America at that time was considered neutral and respected enough that both of those powers simultaneously contacted Teddy Roosevelt and asked him to mediate the conflict between them. That's more where I would like to see America going. I would like America to actually be respected on the world stage and objective enough and helpful enough in terms of humanitarian assistance and in terms of getting Starlink to everybody than putting a hand in the till. To go back to your much earlier question of, like, why aren't we going toe-to-toe with Russia on nuclear war? Because nuclear war would kill 90% of all of Western Europe and America and Canada and Russia if it happened. That is I will say there are definitely people in my country, and they tend to be more in the establishment, that think that if we don't stand toe-to-toe with Russia and do that nuclear brinksmanship with them, they'll just keep rolling forever and ever and ever.
Okay, but then I have a simple question.
I don't think so, though. I think we need to
avoid
nuclear war.
What then would be your trigger for going to nuclear war, then?
If they attack a NATO ally, if they attack us. We are committed by treaty to have a mutual defense pact with any member of NATO, and of course, us. Where this could escalate, and let's hope it doesn't, is if Russia does use nuclear weapons and they, like, the fallout falls on... I should say this would be truly horrible in any situation if nuclear weapons are used. It would further escalate into even worse territory if, I don't know, Russia ends up sending an errant nuclear missile into Poland or something like that. At that point, we're really into World War III nuclear territory. The United States has legal obligations to uphold its treaties. Latvia is an ally of the United States. If Latvia is threatened by Russia, you're a part of our military alliance, and that's something that I would continue to honor. If we were going to ever disband NATO or something like that, it's a different story. But so long as those exist.
And by the way, with NATO disbanding, I would be partial to this because I'd much prefer regional alliances because they'd be much stronger, you know. But that's, again, a whole different side of all of the situation. But currently in Europe, people were very much confused about the fact that how indecisive you are. Like, just tell us your position, like, one way or another. Like, if you're going to declare that, okay, we're not going to support Ukraine anymore, then at least, well, at that point, it would automatically raise up the willingness of the population to aid Ukraine and all of European countries, and, you know, they'd pay much more. I think that would be solved that way, at least. Be like, pick a position and stick with it then. Otherwise, no one knows how to react and what to do.
Here's the two things I would advise people to keep in mind is, one, remember that there's two dueling foreign policy positions in America and have been. I mean, there's from basically World War II until the year maybe 2010, there was a broad consensus. Everybody was Bill Kristol. Everybody was America should go kick ass abroad. Everybody was in that category. Let's go into Vietnam. Let's go into Korea. There was a consensus. That's an aberrant period of American history. For most of American history, we're re-entering this period now. There's going to be two schools of thought, just the same way there is in economics, where one group wants to have a more active government presence, one group wants a less of a government presence.
Most of Russian economists that I listen to call themselves in the Austrian school of economics.
Really?
Yes.
The Russians do.
Well,
I mean, Dmitry, I know. But they're economists anyway, not their...
No, yeah. They're also very libertarian, because I one of the best opposition channels that I watch, by the way, which you'll like, is the Russian Libertarian Party. Is one.
Nothing will make you more libertarian than living under an authoritarian regime.
Yeah, because like these guys are also promoting crypto, but yeah. Like good crypto, in the sense that you should use crypto to buy and sell every day and not just, you know, use it just to invest things in. They're good people, and I know Russian libertarians, by the way, and they would mostly agree with you, except they also apply the same thing to Russia. The fact that Russia should probably invest in its own people. Like,
absolutely.
Because the
Russia's
region...
Russia's a shit show.
Because
it's a horrible regime, like, and a horribly run country.
I just thought this was interesting, because like, I know what Russian libertarians are saying. Russian libertarians are saying, we did not need this war. This war is in every possible way economically not beneficial to Russia at all.
Wars very rarely are. And you're just blowing shit up instead of building things.
Russian libertarians are saying that what Russia should have done is just, one, focus on exporting more than just raw resources.
Actually build up an economy rather than have an extraction petrostate. Sure.
Exactly.
Good call.
And secondly, that right now, by the way, one of the funds Russia is using to fund its drone purchases from Iran is people's pension funds. They literally froze them, and they're using the money from the people's pension funds to just fund war. Which also is, I know that all you libertarians out there are going to just dig this so much, because I thought, and they're saying that the Russian government has declared that, you know, when politics run economy and not vice versa, then very bad things happen. Direct quote today, which I heard in your house while watching my Russian libertarian opposition show. Because, again, I watch all sorts of these people, and sadly, these people like me have been declared foreign agents.
I was about to say, I'll send them some money. They sound like they're much brighter than
Dmitry
the...
Dmitry Potapenko, a Russian opposition journalist, if you want to listen to this, if you're of libertarian leanings. Dmitry Potapenko, he owns businesses in Prague and like stuff. He's a massive businessman, and he basically runs the libertarian thing in Russia.
We'll finish up, but I want to say this for your statement of why don't you guys just make up your mind? I would tell everybody to remember that people my age, I'm 40, people from like 20 to 50 right now in the United States, the biggest singular foreign policy event that we've had that's made an indelible mark on us is the war in Iraq, which was a singular failure, which was something that had incredible blowback for us, cost a fuck ton of money, and resulted in 300,000 dead Iraqis on top of all the people we lost. So there's a much larger intervention skeptic group of Americans right now. And so while I appreciate why people in other countries would want America to go, why can't you just achieve a permanent consensus that we can react to? I appreciate why you want that. But imagine watching the fight we were having about the war in Iraq back when that happened and going, why can't you just all permanently agree on it? There are going to be two camps there, and they're going to go back and forth. Just the way democracy works, it's not that you make a decision and everybody goes, I'm going to personally agree with you and change my opinion forever. You abide by the legal ramifications of that decision. And then if you win the next election, you reverse them. And I don't know that that's something that can really change. The bit that I would apologize to everybody on behalf of Americans is we do have a short attention span, and we are navel gazing. when it comes to foreign policy. And so I think that if you were to poll the American people, I think the funding of Ukraine and sending over arms and money is probably broadly very popular among American people, regardless of Republican or Democrat or Independent, but it's not receiving the press coverage it was 2 years ago. And so it's kind of faded compared to what's going on in Israel and Palestine. And it's just kind of gone to the back. And that really is not even an ideological differentiation. It's just that it's no longer forefront in our minds, and so it's not forefront in that of Congress.
Well, with this, I think I'm going to finish the show on. And hey, you just gave the best reason for my show's existence, to be honest, just now, because I am going to keep this in the forefront because it matters to me. And as you all know, yeah, I've been through a lot, and I need to see this war until an end. But yeah, with this, we can like maybe wrap up this whole situation. And again, like you said, the thing not being in the forefront, of course, there are other problems on planet Earth, but hey, this is mine. There are many rifles like this one, but this is...
Well, I appreciate it. And if I could add just a little bit, I also want to clarify, it's not that... my difference in policy opinion is not born out of apathy for the situation that people in Ukraine are going for or people in the Baltics. Rather, it's I think that we're looking at a very high-stakes situation, and I don't want to fuck it up. And I think people that I disagree with look at me and go, you are Neville Chamberlain. I look at people that I disagree with and go, you are George W. Bush. But the reason that we're having an argument is because we don't want more dead bodies. We don't want bullies. We don't want Russia flouting the international order. And it's very high stakes if we get it wrong. And I very much appreciate you, Christoph, inviting me on to talk about it.
Well, thank you. And like I always say, you're the person that I love to disagree with the most. Because for one, and I hope you all learned this, yeah, we can still... I'm still staying at his place.
Yeah. You're literally sleeping in my bed tonight. Yeah.
I mean, and so should you. The very fact that everyone's so divided, hey, can't you just sit down and have a chat with your buddy and just disagree on something? I bet you can. How about you take that to mind? Because in that case, you'll get more unified America as well. The better results for everyone. But yeah, thank you, Andrew Heaton, for being here. And if there's anything you'd like to add, then, well, the Eastern border requires your last words, comrade.
Happiness is mandatory.
And до свидания, товарищ.
Thank you for listening to the Eastern Border Show. If you have any questions or comments, go to our website, theeasternborder.lv, and leave a comment there. Or email us at theeasternborder@gmail.com. We'll be sure to answer. You can also follow us on social media and contact us there. If you enjoyed this episode, then leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends about us. It really helps us grow the show. And remember, happiness is mandatory.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.